It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all on this Saturday. Good to see Captain Mike Ward.
Good to see you, Captain Sean.
Yeah, back after a couple weeks without seeing each other, so we're back.
Yeah, I mean, you had things going on. You had things going on. I had things going on.
That's fine.
Yeah, so finally got the band back together.
That's right, and a great show coming up as Dr. Sean Powers from the University of South Alabama Marine Sciences and Dolphin Island Sea Lab joining us to talk about a lot. I do want to, like, show notes before we get started. I have had a terrible run lately with the lotteries for the state. No, I can't call it lottery. Chances.
Drawings
for gators, for the gator hunts, right. And then for some of the SOA hunts, the deer and turkey hunts upstate. I did get what I thought I would maybe never get. I drew a sandhill crane.
Did you?
Tag. Yeah, you get three tags there. So now I've got to find. It's all north of Highway 20, right, or I 20, right. North Alabama. So if y'all are, let me just let this show serve me for a second. If you know somebody up there wants to trade like a snapper trip or whatever, fishing trip, to let me access some ground that has sandhill cranes on it, I sure would appreciate it because it starts in December. And it's a two-part season, then it closes a little bit about the new year and then opens up a second part in January. So I've got, you know, probably 30, 40 days to get it done.
But then you do have some public land up there that's also good too, right?
It, from what I've been seeing and the little bit of research I can, because, you know, it's just been opened back up for 5 years now or something like that. So there's not a ton of information online, but it seems like the refuge system, right, that where you can't hunt, holds the sandhills up there, you know, on the Tennessee River. But they fly out usually to private ground because they're feeding in stubble fields and all that. So maybe there's some in-between place. I got to research, but, you know, yeah, that just happened this week. So we'll see. I'll be reporting my travels and scouting and trying to find some sandhill cranes.
You got some people that I think you can call.
I may have called some of those people, yeah, but yeah, we'll see.
I think you'll find some sandhill cranes.
So, I mean, it's just a neat thing, though. I mean, it's one of those stories, and I think we can probably blend this into our discussion with Dr. Powers today, that one of the, you know, when you look at, when you open seasons back or you increase limits, you do that is a tell of the success of conservation.
That's right.
You know, and sandhill cranes were closed for 100 years or something like that. And, you know, the state being open, it's a success story. You know, and you go out there and look at it, that antis or preservationists would look at it and say, what a terrible thing. I look at it and go, what a success story.
That's right.
That, you know, you took something that had been overhunted and had habitat loss, and you fixed it, and you brought the population back to where you can take some. Yeah. You know, I think there's 400 we can take in the season. So, you know, it's over like 15,000 come to the state. So it's good.
Gators the same way.
Yep. These are success stories.
You know, didn't hunt them for years and years and years. Now they're just way overpopulated.
Yeah. And you can take some out.
That's right.
Dr. Powers, you like that? We're talking about critters here, not fish, but they're critters too. We're talking about land animals and air animals. But there's some commonality to fish species too.
Oh, absolutely. And it's always the goal to reopen these. I mean, and then that gets positive feedback from the hunters and fishermen, because now they can see that conservation measures work. They can have more trust, and they're more willing to support us.
Yeah, and that the science, when it says something, is, okay, we got a problem, let's make some changes and fix those and correct those. And I think that's a way. We got a lot to talk about on today's show, but good to get you back. And let's just start with flounder, because, I mean, this, to me, on the marine side, it gets me thinking about flounder and changes made and recovery.
Let's say who Dr. Sean Powers is to start with, what he is and what he does for a living.
Yes, well, other than what you're going for, is he's the emperor judge, the infallible emperor judge of the Alabama Deep Sea Fish and Rodeo.
Well, that's one.
Yes.
That is. The other one is I'm a director of the School of Marine and Environmental Sciences.
Oh, there's that part too. Yeah, I was just thinking about the rodeo thing.
I get to interact with students every day, so that's wonderful. And I also do a lot of research in cooperation with the state and some with the federal government. So,
and he likes to fish a whole bunch.
And I do like to fish a whole bunch. And people ask me, how did you get in this field? And I said, because my dad used to wake me up and tell me, where in the world do you think that you're going to get someone to pay you to fish every day.
Yeah.
And you said, I'll show you.
There was some other expletives there were included. So every day I'm out there fishing, I take a picture and I send it to my dad. And my dad says, I have about 700 of these. Yeah. You can stop sending them. And I say, absolutely not. You will get one every day on the ocean.
You send him a copy of your pay stub, too?
Say, here, no, I don't do that. I don't do that.
It's what I like. I mean, so many people, the way the science-based approach, working with scientists like Dr. Powers, with like Colonel Bannon, with state management, I like people to know that the folks that do this research and are trying to do best are also people that like to fish. Y'all aren't just coming at it like poking it like it's some kind of science experiment. Y'all are people that are, you're in the fight.
Many of us are. I mean, not all of us do, but most of us in our field in particular, fisheries and wildlife in general. There was some experience, and it might have been, in my case, my father and my uncle. It might have been your grandfather. It might have been a neighbor. That's why I'm so excited when people take young people out to fish, because they don't know. I mean, that one event may have a profound impact, and they may want to change the world because of that. And so I really do get a sense of excitement, especially when I see young children out on the boats. I mean, both men and women are out there now. And you know, we want to be passionate about something.
Yeah.
I mean, and even if they don't become a scientist and study it, I mean, they're going to have an appreciation and that conservation ethics that is so, so important.
And that's what I think, you know, when that is proved. So to go back to what you were saying earlier, like, for example, for flounder, right? And there's anecdotal, and you're in the world of science. Mike and I are in the world of anecdotes. But, you know, flounder, it seemed anecdotally, and then was shown with science, this decline. Then changes were made. So science, what you do is you produce the science, and then the state takes it and makes a rule off it. You're not making the rules. You're just saying, here's the science, right? And we made a rule and a change. And anecdotally, and you can help me here, it seems like it's been a success.
And it is panning out. We talked about the break. We are going to finish the new stock assessment on flounder, but it's no secret. I mean, it's going to show what the fishermen are telling us is it's increasing for something. It was Gulf wide. Something happened between,
so it wasn't just here. Okay.
No, 2010-ish and 2015. It varies by state, but almost every state in the Gulf is experiencing problems with flounder. And it was that period that it dropped. And we think, you know, there's a variety of causes, drought, probably over harvest, to some degree in each state, but it was probably environmental conditions.
Well, people were going to say oil spill. You know,
the oil spill could be an explanation, particularly in Louisiana, where those marshes were hit very, very heavily. But we have to recover from that.
Mm-hmm.
So the regulations that we put in Alabama are really being adopted Gulf-wide, because they see how powerful and how quickly this stock seems to be rebounding.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that's really cool about what we're learning about a lot of the bony fish, so not excluding sharks.
Sharks and rays, not,
They're a different story. But the fisheries can bounce back very quickly from over-harvest, from population decreases. We saw that with snapper. I mean, we had some serious changes and almost draconian changes.
The old 16 season,
For a while, but that species bounced back in a relatively short period of time. And it's a long-lived species. Snapper can live 50 years, but it bounces back fairly quickly. And now we're seeing the same thing with flounder. So, and I'm hopeful. I know Louisiana is contemplating some changes to speckled trout and redfish because their populations are experiencing problems. And I'm hopeful that once those changes are made, those populations bounce back fairly quickly.
And I think that's how the snowball builds. You get these success stories and it gives confidence to people that say, okay, they worked on that, then let's try this next one. I have confidence in this.
Yeah, and the changes the state made to flounder were not popular
no.
at the time. I'm sure there's some that it's still not popular.
Oh, I think there's been an opinion turnaround, though.
But exactly, yeah. And that's what you want to see. And we're fortunate in our state that, you know, both Colonel Bannon and Commissioner Blankenship listen to the science, that they seek our input, and then they did the action,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they took the heat. That's the good thing about me. I don't have to take the heat
right.
On those. We just provide the science. But I think flounder, especially in a couple years, if the environmental conditions still cooperate, if the management actions still are maintained, I think it's going to be an amazing success story, right up there with red snapper.
Man, that's speaking of which, and we're not forgetting the fact that I doubt you're snapper fishing today, unless you're real hardy. I think it's 4 foot seas.
It's crazy.
Yeah, and tomorrow's five.
Yeah.
We've got that additional 15,000 pounds here to fish through. And you know what? If the weather stays like this and people go hunting and people go to football games and all that stuff, that may last a long time.
I agree, provided our Alabama football team stay competitive.
Yes, that's true. I wonder if
most people will stay home on the weekends.
Get one of your students to do that. That would be interesting to look at if we ever had, you know, a fall season that was every year, and you could compare the winning record of our teams versus the amount of effort expended to go catch snapper. That would be of interest. But yeah, snapper open now and working through those 15,000 pounds. I think at least with weekends like this, and it'll go slowly. So,
yes,
that's for sure.
Let me ask a real quick question about the flounder before mm-hmm. we get off on another subject. What about the hatchery and raising the breeding the flounder and letting the fry go and all that? How big of a success has that been?
So that is one of the things we're still evaluating. We have the ability, and we're developing further abilities to distinguish the hatchery-raised flounder from the wild flounder. In Alabama, we estimated the population to be about 400,000 or 500,000 flounder. So the hatchery can produce, I think the last time Kevin Ansett told me, was 60,000 to 80,000 small individuals. You know, yeah. Not the real tiny ones, but decent size. So at those numbers, the hatchery can have a major part in the recovery. So we're still trying to see what the hatchery contribution is. And this is unusual. I'm not a real big fan of hatcheries.
Yeah.
But when these numbers for flounder, it can make an impact.
We'll pick this up when we come back after the break. More of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Our guest, Dr. Sean Powers. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward. Our guest, Dr. Sean Powers. And, we talked a little bit of flounder, but that was not on the target list earlier this week, Monday, when we did really a very cool event. I got to be part of. You invited me to do a fishing trip to tag fish. And, you know, it was specific to that. That was our job, going out and talk about this idea about getting these tags in. And what tags were we using?
So this is part of the Tag Alabama project that we have with the CCA. And we've been doing this for now 5 years. We have over 10,000 speckled trout and redfish that we've tagged. We have 200.
What's that number again?
10,000. And wow. Those all have to be legal size for us to tag. And we have about 200 anglers that are registered, probably about 80 active anglers that help us tag fish. And we learn things like movement, growth, mortality, both which the natural mortality they experience as well as the fishing mortality, which is ultimately what Marine Resources needs to know to help manage. So we have all these tags out. People, when they see the tag, they see the website to report it on. It's a cool interface. They can give us as much accuracy as they want with the location. And we send them a really cool T-shirt or hat that says Tag Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And really, people are excited about it. The only way you can get a hat or a T-shirt is that you've actually caught a tag fish. But what we don't know is there's a lot of tags out there, and people have a lot of T-shirts. So how apt are they to call in a tag?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we really need to know, what's the reporting rate? So we, because all we know is who calls in and who goes mm-hmm. through it. So the idea, and we've done this with red snapper, we've done it with a variety of species, is you make the reward for calling the tag in very high. So you can assume it's almost 100%. And then you can see what your rate, how that compares to your regular tag.
Yeah, beforehand, right.
So during the tournament that we had with the guides and pairing them up with some volunteer anglers, we were releasing tags worth $250.
Cha-ching.
Man.
So it's a yellow tag. It will say $250 reward, and it'll give the same contact information. So we have two tags out there now, an orange one that doesn't say $250, and then a yellow one that says $250. So that can help go a long way to paying for boat gas.
Yeah, it will. And now the people that are listening to our show who have friends who didn't listen this morning, they'll say, hey, man, let me just take that. You put that in the car. I'm going to just take that tag from you. You don't want that. I'll just put that in my pocket right here.
Exactly. Yeah. So with that information, you know, that's the key. Then we can turn all of the tag returns in. For example, we get about 18% of the redfish tags called back in. So they've recaptured. We've tagged about 4,500 redfish, and we get about 18% of those back. With speckled trout, we've tagged more, about 6,000, and we only get 9% back. And is that because, you know, redfish are targeted more, or is that because the speckled trout, for some reason, somebody isn't as apt to call in a speckled trout as they are a redfish? The high dollar rewards will help us.
You're trying
know
to clarify that,
that
that information.
So, or they're just not catching the fish.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, but we've had, you know, we've learned tons of stuff about the movement of these. We were talking at the break about mm-hmm. the growth of these over a short period of time. We've had one fish early in the program, a redfish tagged right at 18 inches, recaptured at about 30 inches 4 or 5 years later. So
I was looking at speckled trout data that had a fish that within a year had grown 3 inches.
Yeah. I mean, that
was significant, like from like 18 to 21 or something like that.
So, I mean, any of your fishermen out there, well, maybe they're not out this Saturday, but right. if they catch a yellow tag, just follow the instructions.
$250
and they get $250.
You still get a T-shirt?
You can still get a T-shirt.
Okay,
there you go.
Yeah, okay, so a couple of things come to mind. Number one, is there let's say 18% return for redfish, 9% for mm-hmm. speckled trout. Is there a program elsewhere to use as a, I know all fisheries are different, but as a benchmark, what you should expect? Like, is there, I mean, you know, go into it, do you know what would be normal? I know that's not even a word you can use, but what
no,
would be?
But what we know is we have a stock assessment for the state, and we know what the mortality estimate is for that stock assessment. So, but that's based on landings. That's based on a lot of interviews. You know, these studies, these tagging studies, are designed to tell us, are our assumptions correct? Mm-hmm. Is that mortality rate where it is? Because so much of management is based on that fishing mortality rate. We learn about natural mortality too. We also learn about discard mortality.
Because that's like my list. Yeah, because I got mm-hmm. a list of questions for you on that.
So, you know, what it does tell us, and it might exactly be that the difference between 18% and 9% may be, well, redfish do a lot better when you release them, and there's a lot more release mortality from a speckled trout than we expected.
Yeah, I feel like speckled trout are more – this is the non-science guy coming in, but speckled trout are more like a show pony, and a redfish is more like a mule. You know, I mean, dang, redfish can, you know, sit there in the bottom of the boat for a second. He's just fine.
No, and I would agree with that. We joke because we do a lot of experiments in the lab. Speckled trout die if you look at them the wrong
way. Right, that's right.
I mean, so they're very hard species. But I'll tell you another one. We also have – triple tail mm-hmm. tags out, and we've only done about 224 of those. It's harder to convince someone to catch and release
yeah, right.
a legal size triple tail, but that recapture rate is like 35%.
Is it really?
So those are heavily targeted. And that's a species we don't know a whole lot about, but we know
that's a species that, you know, that can, and you taught me some, but goes offshore. Yep. Not always. Some stay in, some stay out offshore the whole year, and then sometimes. But they're
yeah. So they're all offshore in the sargassum, and then some come in.
Yeah, the idea I used to have till I talked to you is I thought they all came inshore each year, but they all don't.
No, apparently, so far what we're showing is they all don't. So what does that 35% mean? Yeah. Because the whole population isn't exposed to that kind of heavy mortality. But the other great thing about this program is it encourages catch and release.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've talked to a lot of the guides that participate in this. And, you know, one of the things is after they keep a couple of fish, you know, the guide asks them, hey, do you mind if we tag and release? And the guides know about the program. They tell the people. And they have more paying customers who want to tag and release those fish just so that they can contribute and they can know the history of their fish. When the fish is recaptured,
yes,
we send the angler their T-shirt or hat or now a card for $250 if they get the yellow tags. And we send them a report. Here's where your fish was tagged. Here's where you caught it.
Yes, cool.
And over the time. So a lot of people, that's all the information they want. So I think it encourages catch and release. So
yeah, and we talked about it in the past, that I think it's in a weird way human nature of holding coup, like the Native Americans used to, like in battle, if they I could kill you, but I'm not killing you. I have the upper hand. I got you. I'm not going to kill you this time, but I get a point for it. That way, there's something. I think something about tagging that fish is beyond just releasing it. You know what I'm saying? You're releasing it, but I got you. I got you.
And we've had many call in and say, can I keep the tag? And it's almost like, isn't there ducks or something?
Did you look at my notes? Because I was thinking about
it. I did not.
Okay, so that's one of my ideas here in thinking about what we did at this event and trying to get people to return tag information. We are duck hunters, like falling over ourselves when we shoot a banded duck to call in to Pawtuxet, Maryland, there to the and get the information back, and they send you the card that says, you know, that bird was banded in Manitoba in this year, and you know, whatever. You're so excited, and then you display those bands as well, because it's, you know, not every bird has a band. It's very, you know, it's a small percentage of them. So the unspoken language is, you see a person that has a lot of bands on their lanyard, they've killed a lot of ducks. It's kind of a status thing for people to show that off, to the point some people buy them and put them on, which I have a whole lecture for y'all at some point, but you're liars. I wonder if with the tagging, if you got the T-shirt, got the hats. I think the money's a big motivator, but I do. I wonder if there's any way that you display the tags, you know, some way to, as a way to show, you know, if I've caught this many tag fish, how many fish do you think I've caught? You know?
Exactly. So, well, the yellow $250 tags, they have to return them
right, to
us
get the
because
money.
We want proof that. The other ones, they just call in. So if they want to put them in the brim of their hat.
Yeah. I wonder what we start. Yeah, I wonder what you start
it's
to.
It's a good idea.
It is a good idea.
Yeah.
How you could show them off. I don't know.
You know even the $250 ones, maybe you can send it back to them. Say, I want you to keep it as a trophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know how exactly that plays out. But when you said that about bands, I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
It was like duck hunters are like more than excited to give that report, yeah, because they then you get that story, like you said, where that bird came from. Same way you'll find out where that fish came from.
Yeah. The other thing that's critical with this is we do want the fishermen to do whatever they were going to do. So don't release the fish just because it had a tag. If you were going to release the fish anyway because you were over your limit, you know, just snip the tag and release the fish. But, you know, keep it, discard it, whatever you normally were going to do with that fish. We don't want your behavior to change at all because that tag was in that fish.
You wouldn't release the fish, just get the information off of it.
Just clip the tag.
Okay, you wouldn't want them to keep the tag in them and then release them and just send you the information?
Just give us, measure it and clip the tag.
Okay.
And send us the tag.
All right. Coming right back, more with Dr. Sean Powers right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward. And our friend, Dr. Sean Powers, University of South Alabama Marine Sciences, Dolphin Island Sea Lab, a man who put some money out there to get some tags back. These tags, yellow tags. Tell your friend, the yellow tags are the money tags, right?
Correct. We still want them to report.
I'm not downplaying the orange tags either. But
definitely the yellow tags. And fortunately, it's CCA's money. Mm-hmm. CCA has agreed to pay those rewards.
Thank you, Blakely.
But really, the last kind of thing I want to say is, I mean, 10,000 tags out there. And realize that
is crazy.
We
to think.
Spent very little money other than training the anglers to go out there. And tag programs aren't unusual. Fisheries managers in freshwater and saltwater use them all the time. But we are really the first ones to do this large volunteer angler.
And I'll say this, y'all. I'm one of them. I get mm-hmm. y'all can get trained. I know I trained at the boat show, and
yep.
you do the little training seminar how to do it properly, and then you get the kit. So I keep that kit in my boat.
The fact that our colleagues are just amazed that we've been able to get so many fishermen involved to attend the workshops, and that's how you get trained. So you just go to the CCA Alabama page, and they'll tell you when the next workshop is that we'll train staff and we'll give them a kit. But the fact that this is all volunteer mm-hmm. angler and the science, because we're doing this high dollar tag and verifying just a few things we need to verify, it is just an amazing success. The other thing, too, that sometimes the anglers will find is there's two tags in a fish. And they need to report both of those tags because we do.
What's the story on that when there's two
tags?
So
for a subset, so one of the big unknowns with any mark and recapture program like the tagging that we're talking about is how apt someone is to call in a report. The second is what's the natural tag shedding rate we call.
Okay.
So double tagging a certain number of fish tells us that because if they call in the fish and we'll say how many tags it has, it's they said one, and we know it's supposed to have two, we can start figuring out what's the natural tag shedding rate. Because another thing with speckled trout is their scales aren't nearly as tough. It might be that the tag shedding rate with speckled trout is so much higher because you really have to stick that tag behind the fin bones.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a redfish, you don't, even if you don't get behind the dorsal spines, it'll probably stay because that of all those scales. Offshore, we have the problem that triggerfish love to peck off the tags on
other fish. Of course they
do,
because they do that to everything. Because dang, triggerfish leaves nothing alone.
So yeah. We've seen them pull off the tags on amberjack that we've tagged, pulled off the red snapper tag. We don't think there's another species in the bay that kind of has that mm-hmm. behavior, so it's probably just rubbing against things or the tag wasn't inserted correctly.
So that could explain that disparity between the 18% return on redfish and 9% on speckled trout. Because, because part of me is going, well, maybe they just die faster or something. And that's another thing, too. What about, lifespan? You start off, we talked about snapper earlier. Okay, and snapper could be 50 years old. There are so many more opportunities over a snapper's lifetime for it to be caught.
Yep.
Speckled trout lives how long?
About 9 or 10 years is about max.
Okay.
You know,
redfish lives, what, 20?
45.
Okay. That into the calculation at all? That there's more chances to catch that fish before
it is, but usually the tags will only stay for about 1 or 2 years.
Oh, okay.
It's like you. If I put something in your tissue, a tag or anything, your body's going to naturally try to get rid of that foreign mm-hmm. particle. So that's going to happen.
Okay, then, so that evens it up. It doesn't matter the longevity of the species because we're talking about the longevity of the tag, really.
Yeah, correct. Okay. I mean, we've seen tags as long as, 10, 15 years on some sharks, but usually for bony fish, 2-3 years is about as long as that tag stays in.
That answers one of my questions. That's always great to have you on here talking about this. So got this, you know, generally, let's say 2 to 3 year window mm-hmm. when those recovery is going to happen. So what would it tell you if these $250 tags, the yellow tags, start coming in at a higher rate than the previous
tags? So it's going to give us a correction factor. We suspect, obviously, that they're going to come in at a higher rate, but we'll know what percentage it is. So I should tell you
if they come in, if you say
we're going to put about 300 of these $250 okay. tags, we're going to get a couple of fishermen that might do a little better than you did, to help us get that number.
Listen,
out.
I was just riding on the boat.
Hey, your boat did catch the longest speckled trout.
We did, 23.5 inches. Yeah,
exactly, but. You know, that'll be a correction factor. And it's the same thing with the tag shedding rate. We'll get a correction factor for that. So we put out about 300 tags. Blakely at CCA will kill me if I guess wrong. I told him the maximum recapture is probably about 30%. So
you're running the actuarial tables, and this might get Blakey's going, okay, if 30% might cost CCA this much.
He's going to have a fit if it's 80 or 90%.
Exactly. We'll see. You know, science is being put to the test there. But luckily, I'm gambling with somebody else's money.
His pocketbook's getting ready to be challenged, too.
You know what's so great to think about, and you've talked about it, Dr. Power, so many times, is the way in Alabama that the different entities work together. Here you are in the science world. And your job, even though your job is produced, here's science, here's fact. Then the interpretation into what the humans will do or not do is in the charge of Colonel Bannon and Alabama Marine Resources, how to apply that. But then on top of that, you have the private sector coming in, charity, and coming in. Like if you were studying, nothing against studying warblers, right? You're studying warblers, it would just be a government-funded thing. You wouldn't have these other entities stepping up going, that's the thing about something conserving versus preservation, something that we want to consume. You get buy-in from people that are consumers of that. They say, let me help. CCA, let me help.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why a lot of us are excited about this field of science, because our reward is the scientific publications that we write and the recognition of our peers. And that's true in any field of science, because, you know, you need to publish your defendable science in publications and journal articles and get all those academic accolades that me and my fellow faculty members strive for. But we get to do the next step when you do anything with natural resource or fisheries or wildlife management and see that results used immediately. I mean, it's a lot like, to me, the cancer researchers. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously not nearly as important as the work that they do, but not only do you get that satisfaction with the academic accolades, you get to see
real world.
Actually use the science, my science, to help make one part of the natural system better.
Right.
So, yeah.
You get to watch a real world, not just academic, a real world, you know, reaction to that.
And you're right. It's easier with species that people either seek for recreation mm-hmm. or subsistence or food value. And it guides the other field. So we learn so much about the managed species of fish and sharks that it also helps the other species that may not be as desirable on the wildlife side, on the terrestrial side. We've learned a ton about habitat and ecosystems because we wanted to study quail and turkeys.
Sure.
And all of
those
tall
things. Timbers research for quail freaks like me. I mean, tall timbers has done so much for longleaf ecosystems, but it was based in how do you make more quail on the ground.
Yeah,
I mean, that
exactly.
was, yeah. And I imagine that if there weren't ducks that people wanted to shoot, how many fewer acres of wetlands would have been preserved with private dollars, you know, that ended up happening with Delta Waterfowl and Ducks Unlimited, right? I mean, it's because and that ecosystem helped so many other critters, but it's because ducks went there.
And it's true. I mean, if you can go all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, mm-hmm. and you know, we wouldn't have a park system.
Right.
We wouldn't have all of these things if people didn't want to go out and use this mm-hmm. resource. And if we didn't have the management schemes to allow them to use resources. So setting things aside and preserves is a strategy,
mm-hmm.
but it's generally over time conservation and engaging the fishermen, engaging the users is a much more successful strategy.
you know, maybe people don't know this if all you've ever done is seen how we do it here, but we are, I mean, we're different. North American wildlife model, you know, is different. The way, you know, you make the critters the property of all the people and the management responsible on the government to do that versus private ownership.
Well, and it's also not only on a national level, you can see it on a state level. I mean, look at how many people are concerned with marine and ocean and wetlands things in New York, for example. Because there's not a whole lot of fishing and recreational activity involving the water there. Whereas in Alabama, a state that if you ask the rest of the nation would not expect us to be one of the leaders in conservation and science, we are one of the leaders in conservation and science. And a lot of it is because our public use the resource.
Right. It's easy to get buy-in.
You would think Florida would be really up there, too.
I think,
you know, because there's so much more water than we have. We have some of the smallest water space, basically.
68 miles of coastline.
Yeah, compared to Florida or Texas or Louisiana.
Yeah, and it is. And Florida definitely has the capacity with fisheries and everything to really, they have to do a lot of science and a lot of management. But I also think it's because we're used to using what we have in the water, both from an energy perspective as well as fisheries and wildlife resources, where our public just expects us to wisely use those resources.
All right, coming right back. More of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Our guest, Dr. Sean Powers, and we'll remind you about those tags. We're $250. Be on the lookout. Bolo. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you here. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, our friend Dr. Sean Powers. We talk about these, the money tags and the other tags and reporting information. People want to go get more information on this. I mean, is there, I know you said the website's listed on the tag.
So the website to report is listed on the tag. The information about the program is at CCA Alabama page.
Okay, so go over there and
just Google CCA Alabama.
Just get the traffic way up on that part so Blakely Ellis gets really nervous. Hey, Blakely, I just look at your web stats, and this page has gotten so many clicks. Have him start sweating. That's good stuff. But this is something that y'all tell your friends, too. To be aware of these, of the tag. The tags mean something. When you catch one of these fish with the tag, it means something. It helps science for sure.
You know, tagging is awesome. I wish we could do all fish, but something that really intrigues me is the tarpon tagging. Are y'all involved in that at all, in the tarpon tagging?
Yep. We have a set of tags for tarpon, and we've also put satellite tags on those. So float tags that communicate with the satellites.
When that came out, that float that stuff was so cool, watching them, like, some that would do what I thought they were going to do, follow the coast. Some just shot across the Gulf. Some did other things, you know.
Yeah, most of them do a beeline straight for the Birdsfoot Delta of the Mississippi. We've also put those same types of tags, both traditional and satellite ones, on cobia. The problem we had there was cobia are so targeted that the tags just didn't last very long before somebody decided, well, I'm going to keep that cobia. So
how about that? Well, it's just intriguing to me. I didn't realize that they would go across the Gulf like that. I've never seen a tarpon out in the Gulf as much as I fish, but showing their travel corridor. I mean, sometimes, like Sean says, they just cut across the Gulf, and then they go out into 5,000 foot of water.
Yeah, no.
I was told they breed out there. Is that right?
We don't know that for sure. I mean, most of them probably breed in the Florida areas around the Keys and things. The cobia, we learned, we thought all of them followed this migration around the Gulf, but we looks like we have a resident population off of Alabama, Mississippi that go just to deep water.
They do.
And then they come back and they'll spend their whole time here. And then there is a migratory population that swings around. And I suspect we might find the same thing with tarpon.
Yeah. And I haven't seen nothing, none of them that have come from Florida where it's been tagged in Florida and comes up the coast, and you can see where it comes to, you know, Orange Beach or going to Louisiana. I guess they don't have a good tagging program in Florida, or if they do, we're not seeing it.
Yeah, I don't think we're seeing them. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust have done a great job tagging those fish. Yeah, most of ours always go west. Yeah. So I don't know what their origin is before they come here. We do find juvenile tarpon, particularly in these salt ponds on the barrier islands that kind of get limited access to and from. They look like they're the rearing areas for the few tarpon that we have found as juveniles in the system. So tarpon's definitely one of those species we need to learn a lot more about. I mean, there's no commercial value to them, so it usually is the private foundations that step up. For us, the state stepped up and provided some funding because it is the state saltwater fish.
Yeah. So. And that'd be kind of interesting to see, too, what y'all find, and maybe y'all can put something out where see what the speckled trout do, what the redfish do, how they travel, the triggerfish, not triggerfish, the triptail, you know, what they do. I mean, it'd be interesting to all fishermen to see what y'all have in results, what y'all find. Do y'all put out a report on that?
You know, that's one of the things we're also talking about in the break. We're not great at, and we really need to do this, and CCA is going to help us really put out some public synthesis that people can go to and see what these patterns are. We're so worried a lot of times about all the things we don't know that we don't tell people what we do know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's true for most fields of science. And I think we need to do a lot better job doing that, and we will. And we'll post it on the South Alabama website and get a lot of good attention about it. But there's, you know, this area of the Gulf between our program at South Alabama in the Sea Lab and then Professor Jim Franks at GCRL at Southern Miss, I mean, he's been tagging things for so long. And again, I don't think he or I have done a really good job of synthesizing it in a public forum. And again, because I think we get trapped so much with what we don't know that we're afraid to tell people what we do know.
And believe me, fishermen, most of us don't know what y'all know.
Yeah, but as fishermen, we'd like to know that.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I think it would encourage more people to want to get into the tagging system. They can see where their fish gets caught, you know, and see it in a public forum, like with all the tarpon. You know, that just intrigued me, seeing what the tarpon did, how they traveled, and all the hundreds of miles
that
they
traveled. No,
that's
an excellent idea. We'll get together and try to do more of that, because ultimately, we mentioned this is private donor money that's driving us, so we need to encourage more of that. And all the other money we receive.
CCA, y'all.
Yeah, all the other money we receive one way or the other is taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we should do a more effort in saying, hey, here's what we know, and also, you know, here's what we don't know. I mean, but I think, you know, focusing on some of these cool things and the tagging and everything, like we do with the individual angler, and they love it so much, just, you know, just an overall view.
Like a chart. Can you imagine a chart of like the bay and the sound and all that where, you know, here's, you know, travel?
Yeah, where we've tagged most of them, where we've tracked most of them. No,
pretty
excellent
cool.
Excellent idea.
Hey, I want to say we have just 30 seconds here, but I know that at the event we had a little luncheon after the fishing tournament, and the numbers of increase at in the program at the University of South Alabama in sciences, it was something to me. What was that student increase?
Oh, that was our new undergraduate, you know, Provost Kent was there to say a few words. And we went from zero undergraduate students, those working on their bachelor's degree, to 205 in 2 years.
Huh.
And we've also seen similar increase in the graduate. I mean, really, it's going to be, you know, we want those youngers to stay in Alabama and contribute, but we're going to have a gigantic footprint.
And Marine, this is fantastic. Yeah. All right, Dr. Powers, as always, we appreciate your time. Thanks for stopping in. Right, we'll do it all again next week.
I agree.
All right, Mike. Good deal. All right. Y'all send us, you know what, if you want to send us an email about the tagging program, do it, and I'll get it on to Dr. Powers.